1 Timothy chapter 6, starting at verse 17, page 1194. Command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. In this way, they will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so that they may take hold of the life that is truly life. Timothy, guard what has been entrusted to your care. Turn away from godless chatter and the opposing ideas of what is falsely called knowledge, which some have professed and in so doing have wandered from the faith. Grace be with you.
Jonathan, thank you very much. And today's talk is for those who are rich. Through this series on money, we've heard the message to those who want to be rich. We've heard the message to the man of God who needs to resist the materialism of the age. And we're going to see the final instructions to him at the last part of today's talk. But the bulk of our time today concerns those who are already rich. And before we dive in to see what it says, let's just get one thing very straight. I think we all here today are pretty rich, relatively speaking. Apparently, if we have anything other than a dirt floor at home, we're in the top 50% of wealthy people globally. If we have a roof, doors and windows, we're in the top 20%. If we have a fridge, we're in the top 5%. If we have a car, microwave and a door on the toilet, we're in the top 1% of global prosperity. Today's passage speaks to us quite directly, I think. Now, we mustn't feel guilty for being rich. Having money is a good thing. But today's passage teaches us the right attitude to have to those riches, and it teaches the right actions that need to come with it. First of all, our attitude. Just look down again at the first verse Jonathan read for us. The Apostle Paul tells his protege Timothy in verse 17 there, command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain. We've been saying over these past few weeks that materialism is possibly the greatest religion of our age. It feels like our status, our security, our belonging, our satisfaction all depend on how much money we have, how much stuff we've got. The assumptions of materialism are all around us. And so it would be easy, being rich in relative terms, for us to be arrogant. We might not feel rich compared with those we usually mix with, but if I could set you down in a deprived part of London, let alone another part of the world, well, then it would be natural to feel a little bit superior. After all, our society looks up, doesn't it, to those who seem successful, and money is our most basic measure of success. You've only got to think about the annual rich list that the Sunday papers publish as an example of the way that we look up to the wealthy. And even in church circles, we can tend to look up to those who are rich and successful, those who have done well for themselves, is how we put it, isn't it? We listen with just a little bit more respect to the Christian who runs a successful business or is in a senior role in their firm. I suspect if we did a survey of the net worth of church wardens and lay elders, we'd find they were usually better off than the average church member. Although Jonathan and Mark might disagree. No, says Paul, rich doesn't mean better. It may well mean the reverse. It's simply a quirk of this present age. We saw last week, we'll see again today, that it's eternity that really matters. We're not to be arrogant. Neither are we to be complacent. We mustn't put our hope in wealth. Maybe we think we're safe because we're well off. Or more likely, we think that if we'd had just a little bit more, we'd be secure. Paul doesn't need to spell out for us the uncertainty of riches, whether it's through a market crash, natural disasters, mis-selling of financial products, Spanish authorities demolishing dream homes. There are an infinite number of ways in which hard-won money proves so uncertain. It's ironic, isn't it, that what we look to for our security can prove to be so distressingly insecure. Now, much of what I have to say today is addressed to Christians, but let me just speak to you today. If you're not a Christian and you think you're okay because you're well off, think again. Think again. The Scottish preacher Robert Murray McShane said to those who are depending on money instead of depending on God, he said, enjoy your money. Make the most of it, give none away, enjoy it quickly, for I can tell you, you will be beggars throughout eternity. Now that might sound harsh, but it makes the point, I think. We must think beyond this life. Our money doesn't help to get us to the next. Now instead of finding safety in our savings, or our investments, or in our safe jobs, if such a thing exists anymore, we must find our security in God, Paul says. And that punctures our arrogance, doesn't it? It levels us all, rich and poor, down to the same helpless dependence on one other than ourselves. When we gather together as Christians, we are all alike dependent on God. Paul's instruction to the rich to put their hope in God is exactly the same command he made to the helpless widow back in chapter 5, as well as to himself and Timothy back in chapter 4. And we put our hope in God because he is the one who richly provides everything for our enjoyment. Did you notice that in the verse there? God is the one who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Notice again that we aren't ascetics. It's good to enjoy the blessings that money brings. But when we're blessed with the good things of this world, we're not to worship them. We're not to worship the money, the cars, the houses, the holidays. But we're to worship the God who provides them. They are simply a taster in advance of the abundance of blessings that he's promised for the age to come. When we enjoy God's blessings, let's be prompted to think, well, if this is good, how much better is the life to come going to be? What's your attitude then to money? What's your attitude? We've talked about lack of contentment in previous weeks. Well, today it's more the person who's actually quite smug in their seeming financial security. Well, Paul says no. Our finances couldn't be more insecure. We rely on the God who has blessed us in this life to bless us again so much more in the life to come. We are as dependent as the poorest beggar, but perhaps we're more at risk because we don't realise how dependent we are. Our attitude. Let's move on then to our actions, and verse 18. That tells us this. Command the rich to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. Just as the rich are to hope in God like everyone else, they're also to do good deeds just like anyone else. Paul told us back in chapter 2 of 1 Timothy that women must do good deeds. In chapter 5, it's widows in particular who must be well known for their good deeds. So now also the rich must be rich in good deeds. Rich people are not saved in any way differently to anyone else. And the signs of a saved rich person are the same as the signs of a saved poor person. That is a changed life of good works. It's not the good deeds that save us. Jesus Christ and his death for us save us. But good deeds are the appropriate signs of a saved person, whether rich or poor. Now, I think that's a challenge to us, isn't it? In a culture where the rich person is looked up to and maybe relied on for their money, it's easy to think that that's their main contribution to church life. I think we find in our churches a number of people with deep pockets who see their main responsibility as writing a fat check every now and then. And yes, we'll come on to generosity and giving in a minute. But I want us to see that the first responsibility of the rich is the same as everyone else's, that is, to do good works. So when a dirty, practical, inconvenient job comes up in church life, we mustn't switch off thinking that it's for the unemployed person, or the student, or the mum at home. That a call for helpers doesn't include the rich person, because their contribution is just to sign the checks to supply the funds. Have you seen that attitude in church life? Can you spot it in yourself, maybe? Part of the reason, I think, why those of us who are rich hold back from good works is because they're so busy making money. There's a trade-off, isn't there, in this life? Not a perfect trade-off, but a trade-off nonetheless, between time and money. And so perhaps we think that others have time to serve, to visit the sick, to clean the church, to help someone move house, and we have more money than time, so we'll write the checks. And of course, there will be some truth in that. But I wonder whether that's a healthy approach to the Christian life. Are we so busy making money because it's really what our job demands, or is it at least partly because I need to maintain my lifestyle? I need to keep paying the expensive mortgage, go on the expensive holiday, keep refreshing my wardrobe. Are we so busy making money because we've come to identify ourselves as the one in the church with the deep pockets, and we quite like the prestige of that role? Are we so busy making money because we actually prefer to be in the office doing something important rather than getting our hands dirty with the tedious and demeaning needs of church life? If we're too busy for good deeds, regardless of how much money we might be giving, well, then something's wrong. Something's unhealthy in our pattern of discipleship. Can the busyness of making money just be eased back a touch? We need to be good employees, don't we? But do we need the driving ambition to hit our bonus target? Do we need to impress the boss to win that promotion that will just make us busier still? Is there scope for dropping our hours in order to free up time to serve others? I wonder how our bosses would react if we asked to leave on time one night a week because we wanted to visit someone who's housebound and take them their shopping and share a Bible verse with them. 10 years ago, I was working for the barge church at Canary Wharf, and one day, soon after the barge arrived, the plumbing sprang a leak. Now, in those days, I was an inexperienced young chap, and I didn't have a clue what to do. So I rang the man who had largely bankrolled the purchase and refitting of the barge. He's a pretty senior partner of one of the firms in the wharf. I don't know what I expected him to do, but I just said, look, the plumbing sprung a leak. What shall I do? Now, rather than tick me off for bothering him in his high-powered working day, or telling me to call a plumber and saying that he'd pay for it, do you know what he did? He turned up at the barge shortly afterwards, took off his suit jacket, rolled up his sleeves and got down on his hands and knees and fixed the problem himself. Now that's just one little example, but it impressed me as a model of a man who was humble and rich in good deeds. I wonder whether we'd do the same in those circumstances. Or in similar circumstances, if plumbing isn't your thing. Of course, the rich must also be generous and willing to share. Let's go on to that now. Our wealth isn't to be simply spent on ourselves or on our children. It's not just to be stored up in the vain hope of financial security. We are to be generous with it. The word translated there, willing to share, is the word koinonia. It describes a commitment of fellowship. What we do with our money either displays or denies our bonds of fellowship. We've been told earlier in this same letter, 1 Timothy, in chapter 5, that we have an obligation to provide for our relatives. I take it that's our wider family. We have an obligation to provide for those in the church who have no relatives to provide for them. And we have an obligation to provide for our elders and our pastors. Now, often nowadays, the welfare state provides the immediate material needs of the vulnerable in our families and in our church family, although that isn't necessarily the case. But there's a greater need than ever to pay for godly elders to do the work of teaching. Our use of money displays our true bonds. I wonder if someone went through your bank statement with you, who or what would they say you are most attached to? Your house? Your car? Your mobile phone? Your holidays? Or those you're in closest koinonia fellowship with? In doing these things, Paul says we're laying up a foundation for the coming age, what we call heaven. I wonder what you imagine heaven will be like. Surely it will be a place of generous sharing. And so as we live the sacrificial Christian life now, so we're starting to taste heaven and to display heaven here and now. Paul says this is taking hold of the life that is truly life. We're not missing out by turning our backs on materialism and giving generously. Our generosity to others is an overflow of God's generosity to us. If we're rich, well, let us be rich towards others. The philosopher Francis Bacon said, "If money be not thy servant, it will be thy master." Well, let's show money who's boss by giving it away. Often we can be quite squeamish talking about money, can't we? But I wonder whether we take Jesus' command to give in secret a little bit too far. It becomes a handy excuse, doesn't it, to hide it from everyone else. Now, we mustn't give in a showy way to be proud about it, but I wonder whether a little bit of humble accountability mightn't go amiss. How about comparing bank statements or budgets with a close, trusted Christian friend? And I don't just mean your spouse. As Simon said to me when we were talking about it, I take it Ananias and Sapphira were open with each other about their finances, and they were struck down for deceiving the Lord. We've seen throughout 1 Timothy that the church is to be the pillar and foundation of the truth. That is, we're to display what the Christian message looks like as it's acted out in our everyday conduct and in our relationships. What does that look like in our attitude to money and material things? Neil Hannon, who is the son of a bishop, wrote a song called "The Eye of the Needle." The cars in the churchyard are shiny and German, distinctly at odds with the theme of the sermon. And during communion, I study the people threading themselves through the eye of the needle. Now, I don't know whether we should laugh or squirm when we hear that. I drive a shiny German car myself. And again, we're not to despise money or feel guilty for being rich. But the way that we live should be visibly different if we're Christians, both in terms of good deeds and in our generosity. Well, let me just pause on that thought, because in our final couple of minutes, we're going to be turning to a different topic which rounds off our studies in 1 Timothy. Before we do that, I just want to give us a chance to reflect on that challenge to our actions as rich people, both to do good works and to be generous. So let's take a moment to reflect, maybe to jot down some thoughts, and then I'll move on in a second. Well, our final couple of verses address Timothy, the church leader. Verse 20. "Timothy, guard what has been entrusted to your care. Turn away from godless chatter and the opposing ideas of what is falsely called knowledge, which some have professed, and in so doing have wandered from the faith. Grace be with you." Timothy is to guard something precious which has been entrusted to him. I think the precious thing, in the light of everything we've seen in 1 Timothy, is the church itself. He is to take the kind of attentive, protective care of the church that you or I would take if we were asked to look after someone's newborn baby. And he's to protect it by turning away from wrong things. We've seen throughout our studies in 1 Timothy that there are a number of wrong ideas that were being taught in the church in Ephesus where Timothy was. Some people were teaching legalism. That is the idea that we're right with God through religious rule-keeping. Some were teaching asceticism, that it's by self-denial that we make ourselves better. Others went along with materialism, that if we do the right things, God will bless us with riches here and now. We've seen that they are all wrong. Timothy, the true teacher, is to resist such trends, even from amongst other church leaders. He's to make himself unpopular by standing against the trends of the day, by being countercultural, by seeming disagreeable, no doubt, at times. One of the things he'll need to do is challenge the rich, who presumably are paying his wages and whose money he needs to keep the church going. If there's one sure way to frighten the church, it's by offending the rich people in the congregation. And yet Timothy must be brave enough, faithful enough, to risk doing that. So a final challenge as we come to the end of 1 Timothy. It really sums up the challenge of the whole of the letter. Who are you following? Who are you following? Is your pastor, if you're a member of a church, like this? Again, a pause to reflect, and then I'll lead us in prayer. Command those who are rich to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. We thank you, our Father God, for the blessings that you've given us in this age, for the relative great riches that most of us enjoy and take for granted. Please, Father, teach us to be rich in good deeds. Show us where we're making excuses for ourselves. Show us where we're just going along with the materialistic assumptions of our age. And teach us to be generous, we pray. Please raise up a generation of church leaders who, like Timothy, will withstand the wrong teachings of their age, will be willing to be unpopular, will be willing to risk the church finances for the sake of the precious gift that you've entrusted to their care, the Church of Jesus Christ.